From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Advice Show's Meet the Advice CIO series. We're recording this episode direct from Pennyhill Park at Citywire's NMA Investment Retreat. And I'm delighted to be joined by True Potential's Kevin Kidney. He's a head of investments there. And Kevin, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's my pleasure. We'll get straight into it if that's okay. First, with a bit of background on you, if you don't mind, how you got into investing and how you ended up at True Potential.
So back in 2006, I was coming to the end of a postgraduate degree at the University of Strathclyde. I was desperate for employment and I heard about a company in the area called JP Morgan Asset Management. When I went through the application process, I was fortunate to be offered a role there. So I started in the new year, almost 20 years ago, in an operations role. And that was really my first steps into the asset management and the investment management industry.
Nice. As you say, you're at JP Morgan, then you went to Aberdeen, both asset managers. I'm interested in what's kind of distinct about being an asset manager versus investing within an advice business.
Well, so JP Morgan, a very big global asset management company with a number of other affiliated companies such as a bank and mergers and acquisitions. Standard Life Investments, as it was then, a similarly large international institution, institutionally focused. So it manages mandates for large clients. The difference, really, the distinct difference about a advised wealth manager is you are much closer to the client, and also with a vertically integrated advice business, you are surrounded by a number of advisors who all have clients with very, very different needs, different problems, but you really do feel the proximity of your client. And so it's very different from the institutional space where investment consultants act as gatekeepers between you and the actual client, whereas I quite often find myself presenting to advisors and occasionally presenting to their clients. So it's an incredibly different experience.
Right, yeah. And that kind of experience, both sides of the coin, how has that kind of developed your own investment philosophy? And do you even have, really, an investment philosophy?
Well, the difference is you do appreciate that in the advice space, clients are going to contact us as a business whenever markets are volatile. When markets are up and there's no adverse news about investment markets, people can get on with their life. We do see a pickup in calls when markets are volatile, and it's only natural that they want information and they want to be reassured. So we're always ready for that. And particularly over the last 3 years, of course, with the volatility in markets, we've been more than prepared to help them understand that. In terms of our investment philosophy, we'd really have two core pillars. We like to keep it nice and simple. Growth and inflation is what drives the investment outlook. It's what drives investment returns in either equities or bonds. And we have a really elegant way of just analysing and summing up our outlook for growth and inflation in the future. But the key discipline we have is a strategic asset allocation. And that's what keeps us honest. We use building blocks available in the market to map and build into that asset allocation framework. And it's the growth and inflation framework that we have on top of that, which help us decide whether we want to be overweight equities or neutral, and what we do with bonds.
On those questions, I mean, there's plenty to get into there, but at the moment, are there any sectors or asset classes that you're looking to expand into further, whether it's, you know, raising allocations of certain geography or asset class or reducing allocations?
Well, I guess the unique factor about this cycle post-COVID is that normally when you reach a period of full employment and when growth is reasonable, you would start to see government fiscal deficits decline quite materially. We haven't seen that in any major economy since COVID. We know that the US has put through a number of tax cutting initiatives. We know that France is now on its fifth prime minister since the start of last year, as it has tried to rein in its fiscal deficit. And we also know that our current government also tried some modest spending restraint, and that similarly failed. So those prolonged excessive fiscal deficits have actually helped prop up what we would call nominal growth, so the real component and the inflation component. So that's led us to being overweight equities for quite a few years now, following the end of the inflation burst in 2022. And it's actually kept us there. We've been overweight equities. And what we're looking to do now is really examine this idea of breadth. So we've seen global equities, so equities in, say, the UK and Europe, perform just as well, if not even better, than the US over the last 12 months. And we think that can continue. We think tax cuts in the US next year could be just as good for global markets as much as for the US. So we're as optimistic as we've ever been.
Right. And on that US point in particular, do you have a relative underweight, overweight to the US?
So we're overweight in the portfolios. We've been overweight the US equity market for about 2 years. We have a number of fund managers within that who are, and their views do vary about how they wish to express their positivity on the US. But we're not looking to change our view on the US anytime soon. We're perhaps looking more to just add that diversity by increasing allocations to markets such as the UK, emerging markets and Europe, and really spread the chips a bit and add that greater diversification of equities within the portfolios.
Right. You mentioned that you have kind of sub-advised funds. I should say that the True Potential both has in-house funds and delegates management of some funds to external advisors. External asset managers, I should say. So how do you go about picking those external asset managers, and how do you go about deciding to drop them?
Well, so we're now in, we're about to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the portfolios. So they were launched on the 1st of October 2015. And very quickly, we added scale by adding new multi-asset managers to the portfolio range, each with a slightly diversified and differentiated approach to asset management. We wanted to give the portfolios distinct, unique flavors in being able to select from these underlying wealth strategy partners. And it could be someone like Pekti, who have a very thematic approach, or it could be someone like Schroders, who have more of a value and a relative value approach and are willing to take quite distinct bets in the market, such as they, rather than US equities, they prefer global equities such as emerging markets in Europe. But they also are willing to make material asset allocation positions, such as favouring gold over bonds. So these are distinct approaches that these managers have brought to the portfolio range. Mm. And that's what we're delighted to be able to bring to clients.
So does that suggest that for the asset managers you look to work with, that you appreciate a kind of active approach, managers who are more willing to take, I suppose, bolder bets?
Absolutely. I think being active is key. We want to outperform for our clients. The key discipline is having an asset allocation framework, or a North Star, as we would call it. We want to be able to understand what is the guiding principle for each of our managers, what keeps them honest and what keeps them true as the cycle evolves. But of course, we want them to have the conviction to outperform their asset allocation framework to try and deliver those excess returns for clients.
Yes. Obviously, that doesn't always work out. So I think that was the example in the last 6 months or so of a mandate switch for 7am. So they were dropped. Could you kind of use that as a way into explaining the process of what happens when you do decide to move away?
So there's two dynamics there. One is that within the portfolios, the team had been underweight an allocation to 7IM really since about the start of 2023, perhaps didn't share their slightly pessimistic view on global growth, particularly in the US. We were constructive US equities. They were more cautious and had a slightly more elevated risk of recession than we thought. So we were underweight from 2023 onwards. In parallel with that, we also had the assessment of value cycle, which is run by our ACD. And that had identified for a couple of years that performance delivery there had been slightly worse than was expected. And so that really brought us to the conclusion, working with our ACD, that the years of underperformance and the poorer delivery did mandate a decision about the future of that fund range.
And so you mentioned the assessment of value reports there. When a fund is flagged red for underperformance, what does, or amber for underperformance, what does the process look like from that point? You mentioned on your website that you kind of engage with them, with these providers more. What does that look like in practice?
Well, it could just be that their investment style isn't really in vogue. Right. So to give you an example, if a manager has a particularly strong conviction in value investing, and the period 2023-2024 was really dominated by growth stocks, particularly in the US outperforming, it could just be that their style is underperforming, not because the manager's made the wrong decisions, but the market is just evidencing a slightly different style bias. Where the manager wouldn't have that excuse, it's important that we understand and we engage with them on their asset allocation framework, any tactical decisions they've made, particularly where they do make substantial deviations from that asset allocation framework, mm-hmm. perhaps where they don't have as much conviction in their North Star as they have had in the past, and really just do deep dives with them to understand the level of tracking error or risk they have in the portfolio and ensure that there's a coherent narrative behind those investment decisions. And that, I guess, the 7IM case study was what we went through from about 2024 with them.
Yeah. So that point on kind of conviction and the importance of having a strong narrative behind asset allocation decisions, does that suggest that you're sometimes willing to, I suppose, bear periods of underperformance or deviation from a benchmark if that conviction is being held and if there's a kind of cleaving to a North Star?
I think it's only right that we will see our managers from time to time deviate from their benchmark or their asset allocation framework. That's exactly what we would expect them to do if we want them to be truly active. What we're always looking for is a consistency in why those deviations exist, that there's a clear narrative, a robust framework, and that they have perhaps built into those positions. They're not, haven't taken too much active risk, mm-hmm. but critically that there's always some diversification in the portfolios, because we do run multi-asset portfolios. So we always want bonds to be able to add value when equities underperform, or equities to lead in a period of high nominal growth such as now. So it's important that we engage with the managers frequently just to ensure there's a consistent narrative about the active decisions they've made.
Mm. Looking at the most recent assessment of value report, some of the UBS funds, I think, were flagged for underperformance. Where are you at with those funds now?
Well, we're just engaging with them proactively, really. It's important to note the funds were all marked as delivering value. Mm-hmm. It's just that the assessment of value cycle for True Potential is up to the end of April. Of course, Liberation Day was just about 4 weeks before that. So we were in a particularly volatile period where that snapshot at the end of April perhaps didn't favour as many managers as we would have hoped for. So we've just engaged with them just to try and understand what their views were. And of course, the performance recovery since then has reassured us.
Right. Thank you. And from your vantage point now, do you anticipate any further changes, fund closures or mandate switches over the next 6 months?
Well, it was a very strong report. We're mm-hmm. delighted with the individual contributions to the portfolios for clients. It's one of the reasons why the funds remain in the top quartile of the ARC peer groups. All of the managers have made a contribution to that success. So we engage with the managers frequently just to ensure that we understand their views. And of course, because we run a discretionary overlay, we're always looking to position the portfolios that in a way that best meets our view. And that occasionally means we sometimes take allocations to managers down, and we'll allocate that capital to the manager which we believe is most likely to outperform as the cycle continues.
Right. Thank you. Just returning to that 7IM example for a second, if that's okay. When those funds were closed, assets were moved to in-house funds. Is that something you might look to do more often to increase allocation to True Potential's own funds?
So the decision there was made by our ACD, which is they had, as always, when thinking about price and value within the Consumer Duty, they had determined that the risk profile of the internal fund range, the growth aligned range, was the most appropriate match for 7IM. But of course, the growth aligned range is actually cheaper. So it felt just the natural decision for those assets to move into the growth aligned fund range. And we were actually able to lower the overall cost of the portfolios to clients as a result of that decision. But we're not planning any other major allocations into growth line. We're very proud of the track record. It's a premier fund range. It's got a tremendous track record, particularly over the last 3 years. And we hope it continues to be a major part of the success of True Potential Investments.
You mentioned earlier the discretionary overlay that you have. I'd be interested to know if there's anything, any interesting moves that you've made in the last couple of months. I mean, it's been a volatile time in markets. Anticipating the future is more difficult perhaps than ever. Any moves that you've made?
Well, I have to credit George Bell and the team there about some decisions they made about 10 months ago and have continued with, which was, had real conviction that we would see breadth in the equity market. That is, other markets would be able to catch up to US outperformance, and had, so they added to places like European equities, or they added to managers who were overweight European equities. One of those changes was adding to Schroders. But because of Schroders' unique approach, where they have a material holding in gold, have a very low allocation to bonds, that decision was able to bear fruit for the fund range through the first quarter, because the volatility from Donald Trump meant equities, particularly in the US, were hit. And so that fund range actually contributed materially to the portfolio's performance through there. Other changes we've been making would be just looking to add to Schroders in some of the income portfolios, just to add diversity to the portfolios and maybe continue with that theme and that confidence that markets outside the US can contribute as much as the US to future returns.
One thing that's distinct about True Potential is your size and the kind of pace of your growth over recent years. Now we're at about £33 billion assets.
Thereabouts.
What has that scale kind of allowed you to do that other advice businesses maybe haven't been able to do, in looking at kind of economies of scale or share?
It's precisely that. First and foremost, it's economies of scale. Mm-hmm. So year on year, we've been able to demonstrate a lower cost, a lower OCF for the portfolio range. And in fact, some of the portfolios have seen their costs lower by about 18% since inception. So over the 10 years, a very credible demonstration of economies of scale. What we've also started to be able to do is with the underlying fund managers and some of the manufacturers of ETFs or index vehicles, for example, start to build strategic partnerships. Because of the success we've had with our clients and the confidence they've placed in us, we have allocated material capital into some of the ETFs available in the UK. And that makes us able to negotiate better fees, but also makes it more of a critical relationship we build with people such as BlackRock, for example, such as Amundi, where we can think more about the future, about as the growth of True Potential continues, how do we want to build the relationships with manufacturers, perhaps to enhance products, but also to drive down the cost of ownership for clients, also increase transparency as well, because the great thing about ETFs is clients can just look up that ETF and can see what the holdings are straight away and how they change day upon day.
So with that kind of critical relationship, how does that kind of work in practice? Is that kind of regular meetings, kind of scrutinising decisions that the asset manager might be making, or getting an insight into their
practices? Not so much for the manufacturers of ETFs. We're really just looking to keep them up to speed with developments in our business,
right.
Because the success we've had means we've been able to direct material capital into these index building blocks. What we've been able to do with the appointed multi-asset managers is really give them confidence that we are taking a long-term view, that we're a growing business, and that should they demonstrate a clear narrative which fits with our view, then they can be as much a part of the success of our story.
Mm. The True Potential fund range, when compared to other kind of large advice businesses in the UK, I think I'm right in saying it's relatively small. Is that a deliberate thing? And do you have plans as assets under management continue to grow to expand the kind of fund range that you offer? And if so, where might that expand?
So I think this is testament to the founders of the business, who wanted a very simple offering, so risk profiled for clients dependent upon where they are in their savings cycle, whether they're near retirement or whether they're at the beginning of their journey. And that's why we have the five core funds, which are risk profiled by Morningstar. We complement that with 3+ portfolios. So for clients who perhaps have a slightly greater appetite for risk within 3 critical risk profiles, they can choose to take a slightly more elevated risk. And we have 2 income portfolios which have tremendous track records. So there's a tremendous complement there where you have these accumulation strategies, the core, complemented by the income portfolios. Where we're cognizant of in the UK is that the country is getting older. There is a greater need for, I think, the provision for retirement solutions, not just retirement advice. And so we need to, I think we're going to focus next year on how we can think about enhancing solutions for those in retirement and complement the existing income portfolios we have.
Right. Have you started that process off yet? And speaking to asset managers in the income space?
What we have started to do is engage skilled manufacturers of solutions and just let them speak to us about what these solutions could do if they had a partnership with a firm which could offer scale. So we're really just at the beginning of a journey and understanding the market, exploring what a decumulation or a retirement solution could look like. The next stage, of course, would then be engaging our advisors to work out what they believe their clients need and trying then to find a solution that works for everyone.
Got you. Just on some specifics, if you don't mind. So would that take the form, do you think, of a separate kind of fund of funds?
I'm open-minded. I think what we have today is a very strong income portfolio group where for those who require an income stream who are perhaps post-retirement but don't want to sell units, they can draw down from that from that income stream, but it isn't necessarily a complete solution. Clients perhaps would like to have some of that income sitting in cash, or perhaps would like a greater security over those income flows. So there's a tremendous possibility for us here to speak to people who could perhaps provide annuity-like products without our clients being locked into an annuity, where obviously then they can't then benefit from an increase in interest rates if that comes around in the future. So I'm very open-minded about the product innovation that's out there for UK clients.
You said next year. Could I press you any further on when next year?
Well, we don't. It's really just a conversation right now. What I would like to do is have as many introductions as possible as I can with expert manufacturers in decumulation or in fixed interest type products, and really build the knowledge within True Potential about the possibilities for enhanced retirement solutions.
So I'm sure there'd be plenty of manufacturers keen to speak to you on this. Could you give them any advice on what they ought to try and do?
I think simple language is a godsend. It is critically important to know the room and understand that not everyone in the audience is necessarily an investment expert. So know your audience, get to the point quite quickly. You know, these studies which show it's usually the first 20 minutes of a meeting which is critical. You really want to use that first 20 minutes, 30 minutes to make your pitch, get your point across, probably repeat your point 2 or 3 times so that message, you know, is driven home. But it's always important then to try and make it more conversational, invite questions, perhaps direct a few points to members in the room just to try and elicit that conversation. But I can never overstress that it needs to be simple so that everybody leans into the conversation.
Do any stick out for you in that's dozens, hundreds you must have had in there?
So I think we're always engaging with active managers, particularly within the growth aligned fund range. One of the best, and we're always looking for managers who are perhaps in a part of the market which is a bit differentiated, where there's a very clear story there for differentiation. One of those I would always highlight is back in 2023, we met with Man and their new dynamic income fund, which had just launched. And it's in a very unique part of the fixed income space. And we met with the manager, Jonathan Golem. And as a former fixed income fund manager myself, I was smitten by his investment strategy. And this was an individual who was very clear about his investment skill in that space. Very confident about what this fund can do. Also very confident about what this fund would not do and who it may not be appropriate for. So we followed Jonathan for almost a year as that fund grew, and then we were able to make an allocation to it when it was roughly $250 million in AUM, and today it's $4 billion. So we're able to give material capital to that manager early in the success story of that, and it's been a material contributor to the success of Growth Aligned.
That point of getting in slightly early, I feel like I'm seeing it increasingly often that advice businesses or wealth managers are looking to seed, or if not seed, provide capital early to funds, often from American asset managers who are trying to set up shop in the UK. Is that something that you're looking to do, maybe access preferential share classes that way? And more broadly, do you think that could be the direction of travel for larger businesses?
So true potential? I think it's critical to have a dynamic research process that allows you to move at an appropriate pace. If you identify a new investment product which is of benefit to your clients, and the Man Dynamic Income Fund is probably a case study in that, where we were able to have a robust but dynamic research process where we were able to recommend and get that fund approved for inclusion in the Growth Line fund range. Of course, we're always looking to get that at a price point which works for our clients. And because we're a credible asset allocator, a growing business, and we can perhaps from time to time allocate capital quite quickly to a new investment manager, it does allow us to negotiate competitive fees and perhaps to be rewarded for being an early investor and an anchor client in these type of investment vehicles.
You mentioned the importance of kind of driving down costs. One way some big advice businesses are doing that is by increasing their passive exposure. Is that something you might look to do in the future?
I think there's a critical need for index type products in any investment portfolio. They are a true representation of any strategic asset allocation framework. They're very, very pure. And of course, you can use these instruments as well to take active views. If your asset allocation framework is 60% in equities, you could use ETFs to go to 61 or 62%. I think for True Potential, we are always, and we're quite evangelical about active management. And that means not being 100% passive. I think if you go down the 100% passive route, clients will lose the contact with the manager because they are effectively investing in a vehicle where they perhaps will not have a relationship with an investment manager. They won't understand changes to the portfolio quarter upon quarter. We're also quite confident that we are fairly good at selecting active managers, both within Growth Aligned and making active decisions in the discretionary overlay within the True Potential portfolios. And it's that belief in active management which will fuel further belief in us continuing to manage actively, but also continue to look for new funds for Growth Aligned or potentially for new managers within the wealth strategy range for the portfolios.
Mm-hmm. Talking about newness, one thing that's been discussed at the conference today is ETNs, or crypto exchange traded notes. The FCA is going to make it possible for retail investors to access those vehicles from October. Do you have any interest in them?
I do have to be honest, I just don't see it being a part of the portfolio range or any of the fund range in the short run. I think that we have a very clear mandate to grow our clients' money. We want to grow those assets in excess of inflation and give clients a real return. We've been very successful in doing that in the last 10 years without Bitcoin. I've got incredible confidence that we can continue to do that without Bitcoin. But never say never. I think if we see the same type of institutional take-up here in the UK that Bitcoin has had in the US, then that may just foster perhaps a less pointed conversation about what crypto can offer in multi-asset portfolios. But there is a bit of a health warning with crypto. It has immense volatility, and I'm not entirely convinced it is an inflation protector. It's a new and emerging asset class, which I'm sure will dominate the headlines. But we need to just be a bit more mindful with our clients' capital when it comes to things like crypto, ledger type instruments, or stable coins.
Yeah. Another asset class that is dominating headlines lately is private markets. There are new vehicles launched kind of aimed at retail investors, long-term asset funds being the most prominent. Do you have any interest in allocating to private markets, and have any of those vehicles that are getting talked about, like LTAFs, appeal to you?
Not yet. So I think we've had a steady stream of research in this area for over a year. The price point is just doesn't work, I think, for our clients. These funds are typically very, very expensive. Now, I fully expect that price point will come down over time, and they will start to look a bit more attractive from that price aspect in a relatively quick space of time. Something we do offer in the portfolios, of course, is daily liquidity, and you just can't be expected to get that from private assets. So I'm open-minded that eventually private assets, LTAFs, can perhaps complement a multi-asset portfolio, but not dominate it. Mm-hmm. And that's fine where, you know, other instruments, these index building blocks we've spoken about, can offer the liquidity that we need. And perhaps in a relatively short space of time, LTAFs can be a complement to multi-asset portfolios, but we're not there yet. We need to do more research. I think we need to see a broader take-up in the market. We probably need to see a greater prevalence of manufacturing. And that way we can then enhance our research into the area.
Right. Thank you. Now time for I suppose a tricky set of questions that you've been asking throughout the series, your best and worst investment decisions throughout your investing life. You can start with best, you can start with worst.
I'm going to start with the worst. And it's really just a deep regret I have about the period before Brexit in the UK, where we had, as a fixed income fund manager then, we had a high conviction that the country would vote to remain. And of course, that's not what transpired. And we had gone through a rigorous risk management approach. I think, you know, I regret that period because I just didn't outperform subsequent to that vote in 2016. And I don't kick myself about the risk management process we had, but it was just such a shock on the 24th of June, yep, that I do look back and think, wow, how did that happen? And in terms of, you know, an investment decision that I'm proud of that my team made, it's really going against consensus towards the end of 2022, when inflation had clearly peaked and equities, particularly in the US, looked relatively cheap. Senior members of our team developed a nominal growth theme. That is, growth would hold up and the equities would more than capture that future growth. So we were relatively quick in the portfolios to add to equities, and it's proven to be a great, great result for clients investing in our portfolios as measured by peer groups such as ARC, where we're top quartile. So I'm immensely proud of the decisions the team made, and going against the consensus, being brave, being bold, and using asset allocation frameworks under growth and inflation dynamic to benefit our clients.
Thank you. One final question, if you don't mind. What do you like to do in your spare time?
So I'm an avid gardener, which isn't necessarily the most exciting activity. I also like to spend time with my children, particularly on holiday. They're 8 and 11. It's a great age.
You're busy.
Yes, but they're tremendous fun, particularly when we're on holiday. So gardening and holidays are pastimes at the moment.
It's a good life. Kevin, thank you so much for your time.
From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.